If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, a very big hello to you once again. You are listening to Planet Porky. I'm on Planet Porky, and I have to say, the other more glamorous than me resident of Planet Porky, rock chic extraordinaire, Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how's life treating you?
Oh, not bad, Michael. Thank you. You're too kind.
Well, that's very kind of you. As this podcast comes out, we are literally one day away from pub opening, but we won't dwell on that again. We've said enough about that already. I just want to tell everybody, please adhere to my mantra, which is blado in modo. That means bladderation in moderation. If you go for a drink tomorrow, good luck to you. I may shy away from that until maybe Sunday or Monday, but let's hope it all goes well. Now, Leslie Ann, we're going to start off with a fantastic story this morning, a frisson of absolute delight when I pointed out to you the other morning that I put a tweet out to celebrate her birthday, one of the, in my view, most glamorous singers of my lifetime, Debbie Harry, a woman so beautiful, they named the group after her, Blondie, and somebody with whom you have had quite an interesting association.
Well, yeah, I have, because not only did I work with her at Chrysalis Records when I was on the staff there years ago, back in the 80s, but then when I became a journalist, I interviewed her a few times. And one sort of memorable occasion when I spent 3 days with her in New York for an exclusive spread for the Daily Mail. And we painted the town red.
Really?
And purple and green and every other colour you can imagine. Yeah.
Did you go anywhere I might have gone in those days, you know, all the, you know, the chic restaurants, bars, all that kind of stuff?
No, Debbie wasn't about chic. She was about new wave and underground.
Oh, right.
Sort of sleazy. She liked the basement clubs, you know, the sweaty little dives.
Oh, not for me. Yeah,
she was into all that. And she was quite a tough bird, you know.
Yeah.
Probably still is. She's 75, but I can't imagine that she's changed that much. Hmm. She'd had quite a tough life.
She
was adopted. I don't know whether you knew, she started life as Angela Trimble. Born in Miami and given up for adoption as a little baby and taken by a couple to live in New Jersey. Hmm. She'd sort of left home at 16. She became a Playboy bunny. She went through a lot of scrapes. You know, you can imagine, can't you, the kind of come-ons you get from the rich guys.
Oh, absolutely.
And then she started singing as a backing vocalist. She met Chris Stein. They formed a few bands together, which eventually evolved into Blondie.
Right.
And the name of the band came from the catcalls that men used to yell out at her when she dyed her hair blonde.
So she's back at the building site and it's all Blondie. Yeah. I get it.
But she went to great lengths to say, look, Blondie is the band and I'm Debbie Harry. I'm the lead singer. But of course, the two always merged into one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So Blondie was Debbie Harry, really, always in our understanding.
It's interesting about the New Jersey connection because, of course, one of their big hits was Union City Blues, wasn't it?
A great hit. And
New Jersey Town. Yeah.
Endless songs. Heart of Glass, The Tide is High.
Yeah.
Call Me. Sunday Girl was always my favourite. Absolutely love Sunday Girl.
I think Denise was the one I liked.
Denise. She's a very nice woman. I mean, she was very down to earth, very basic. She'd had lots of quite extraordinary things happen to her. She was raped at knife point in her apartment, which she shared with Chris Stein. I went to that apartment, actually, and this is grotesque.
Sorry, she was still living in the same apartment where she'd been raped.
People tended to in New York. I don't know whether they still do, but if you managed to get these rent-controlled apartments, downtown, and they got them for a song, and they tended to live in them for decades, because why would you move? You know, New York real estate is so hard come by.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially rentals, so they tend to stay in the same ones.
Yeah.
But on the radiator in the main living room of this apartment, they had a snake. It was a massive great thing. Must have been
a boa.
A snake, an actual snake.
What, a live snake?
No, it was dead and it was stuffed.
Oh.
A kind of preserved, I guess, in some way, you know, like taxidermy.
Yeah, sure,
But it was on this radiator all along the wall underneath the windows in this apartment. Yeah. And when the radiators came on, this snake sort of warmed up and it started sort of hissing and puffing. It was very disconcerting.
Good God. How horrible is that?
Really horrible.
Oh, dear. Well,
it's quite punky, isn't it?
It is quite punky. She had a theory about her own background, didn't she?
Yeah, she... Well, she told me this one night after a lot of drink.
Yeah.
She said, although I tracked down who I presume to have been my birth mother, a concert pianist living in Miami, who rejected her, this was the kind of official story, she said she believed that she was the actual daughter of one of the greatest Hollywood sirens ever known.
Really?
Yeah.
Golly.
And she told me who she thought it was as well. Yeah. Now, I worked it out. I sort of went away and did a bit of sleuthing. Yeah. This particular siren would have been about 19 when Debbie was born in 1945.
Golly.
So perfectly possible. There's a very similar look as well. I compared pictures.
It doesn't take much of an imagination to guess who you might be talking about there. But of course, as you quite rightly say, Debbie Harry's hair was dyed. And if you're talking about sort of that era, Hollywood...
Wasn't everybody's hair dyed?
But in the 1940s, that was when a crop of astonishing Hollywood sirens were born. That was the golden sort of start age of Hollywood, you know, into the 40s, the 50s and that kind of stuff. So it could be a number, but I'm sure everybody's got an image in their head of who Debbie Harry looked like. I only ever met her once, and I met her because the guy you've mentioned, Chris Stein, her boyfriend, had some terrible illness. And we used to have, like everybody else in New York, you had people on the payroll. And one of the people to get him well with were the limo drivers, you know. And I got a tip from a limo driver that he was running Debbie Harry to Mount Pleasant Hospital every day. Mount Pleasant, of course, is the name of a suburb in London where the famous post office is. So you never forgot it, you know. And I said, oh, really? So I went there and I waited for a couple of days, never spotted her. And then on day three, I spotted her because she was dressed like a bag woman. I didn't spot her because she was dressed like a bag woman. I thought, I just don't get this. The guy said he brought her here again this morning, right? And honestly, she had a coat on buttoned up to her neck, glasses, a hat pulled right down over her face. I mean, she was invisible to anybody else as Debbie Harry. She looked so unlike her. And she was pulling a trolley around like, you know, like the bag women do of New York. It was astonishing. And eventually, you know, she continued who she was. And she told about this terrible illness that he had. Did he get over it, by the way?
He did. The illness you describe is pemphigus, which is a really nasty flesh-eating disease. And he was sick with it for a very long time. It sort of caused Blondie to disintegrate, as you might expect.
Yeah.
But they did make a comeback. They did get back together again. And
the
sad thing was that she nursed him through this disease.
Yeah.
She eventually got him home and she nursed him back to health. But the relationship didn't survive.
No, I honestly wouldn't think it would in those sort of circumstances. But what a fascinating woman. And she made it to 75. She went through a few periods recently when she sort of put a bit of weight on and that kind of stuff. But you can imagine that of any woman getting to that age.
Well, don't we all, darling?
Oh, well, of course.
I thought the most fascinating thing about her was that she was immortalised by Andy Warhol.
Yeah.
Do you remember she sat for that one famous session?
I do.
And she said that the thing she took away from that session was that he said to her, don't be mired in the past.
Yeah.
Always look forward. Always try new things. And she took that lesson into her life. And that's why she's still making music and making films at the age of 75.
God, absolutely amazing that. Just before we move on, by the way, because I want to talk to you about litter, but a very similar sort of woman, Baywatch's Pamela Anderson. 53 this week. I don't suppose you bumped into her, did you, during your long and distinguished career?
Oh, I never did. But, I mean, obviously, we used to watch Babe Watch.
Yeah, exactly.
Tit Watch, as we used to call it.
Oh, come on now. Come on. It's a family show.
Well, it is. But yeah. I think I must say this, that if you've made your career purely on your looks and your sex appeal,
yes,
there's no hope for you. You've got to have a bit more.
What do you mean no hope? I'd just cash in on it. People wanted to, you know, shower me with millions just because of my good looks and the fact that I was, irresistible to women. I'd take all the millions and not worry about it. I don't have a conscience about it, believe me.
Well, she didn't make millions and she doesn't make anything now. You know, Baywatch is long gone. Hmm?
She should have done for, you know, that she, I mean, she had the world TV market captured. She should be a $100 million woman.
No, there are not millions in those television series. You know, they don't get royalties, they don't get residuals. Yeah. Once that game is up, you know, you're looking for another gig. And if you've got nothing else, no other string to your boat, other than your sex appeal, where are you going to go from there?
Well, it's a good question. I suppose you marry some nutter of a drummer, don't you, for a group who's covered in tattoos or something like that. And then that breaks up, obviously, fairly quickly.
Now, the money doesn't last forever is the bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely right. Now, getting on to litter, I'm outraged because all these gatherings we've seen, including Liverpool fans getting together to celebrate their club's Premier League victory. And I don't want to sound bitter here because I'm not what's described as a bitter blue on Merseyside. I'm an Everton fan and I congratulated Liverpool on winning the Premier League title. But did they have to leave so much filth behind and then attack, you know, one of the most iconic buildings on the shoreline of this country, the Liver Building in Liverpool, leave all that filthy litter around? What about all these bums who congregate in London, leave litter there, and all these people on Bournemouth and Brighton beaches? I think we've got to bring in very severe and very enforceable crimes against litter bugs.
I absolutely agree with you, but how does one police this? I know I saw
litter wardens.
Well, on Bournemouth Beach, they had police strolling up and down.
Yep.
But they are surrounded by thousands of people. And this is gross, but I'm going to say it because people need this rammed down their throats. Pardon the expression. People defecating into food cartons and leaving them on the beach.
I know, it's disgusting.
How do we stop that? Because that is inhumane, as far as I'm concerned.
Disgusting
behaviour. And there has to be a way of stopping it. How do we do that?
Yeah, well, we've got to get some laws in line to get it. Because when you've got to clear up 300 tonnes of rubbish because people have had a day on the beach, then the whole thing's out of order. I would close the beaches until people got to learn how to behave themselves. And we've got to put public facilities in place to make sure those disgusting things that you refer to don't happen again. Talking about beaches, by the way, lockup is lifted as well as the pubs opening tomorrow. Are you going on holiday?
I'm supposed to be in Italy right now. I was meant to fly yesterday with my three kids because some friends of ours were having an anniversary party in their palatial new place outside Perugia,
right,
which they bought a farmhouse and restored it over the last 3 years. And it was going to be their wedding anniversary party right now, tomorrow night. We're very disappointed. So are they. But both parties in that couple are doctors,
right?
And so they were unable to leave. They also said it was immoral to have a party in a country where so many thousands of people had already died.
Yes,
and so they've deferred it to next year. But do you think I could get my money back from Ryanair?
I don't know. Have you tried?
Yeah, of course, but there was no way. So quite frankly, I'm not flying Ryanair again.
Right. OK, well, I think that'll be the same problem with all the airlines. Maybe, you know, if it was EasyJet, it might have been the same. I don't know. It's very strange times, isn't it? But are you then planning to rearrange this trip?
They have rearranged it to June next summer.
Oh, not this year then. You won't be going
there. No, next summer. But see, my daughter will be in China by then working for a year. My son might be on the road because musical theatre might be back by then.
Yeah.
My other daughter is planning to go roaming.
Right.
Do I really want to go to a party by myself? You know,
No, I understand what you're saying. I'm very seriously considering a flight to New Zealand. Because,
oh, really?
Yeah, I've always wanted to go to New Zealand. It's one of the few places in the world I haven't been. Been to Australia a few times. Love Australia. I like the Antipodeans. They've gone a bit sort of woke, like the whole of the rest of the world, but not as woke. You know, the Australians are very realistic. But I've never been to New Zealand, and I think I'd like to. Now, the thing is, if you're if you're able to, you can get a, I can get a flight to New Zealand, club class, you know, business class, there and back, for about $3,500, okay? And yeah, it would be on a virtually empty plane, because I've researched all this, and it'd be a fantastic experience. And when I got to New Zealand, nobody there has got COVID, so I'd be completely safe, you see what I mean? So it might just be the right time to take up, you know, something I've been wanting to do for years, and, you know, I'm not going to be living forever, and it might be a great opportunity.
Well, go for it, Mike. I mean, I think if we've learned one lesson from this whole lockdown experience, apart from the fact that we need to live more cautiously and more cleanly, the other lesson has to be grab life by the hands.
Yes.
And if there are ambitions unfulfilled, go for it. Go and do them.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The other places I've investigated going to are the Isle of Man, because there's no COVID there, okay, and Guernsey. There's no COVID there. But it's not quite as glamorous as flying, is it, you know, halfway around the world in a big jumbo jet in business class. And also, when you get there, there's not, it's not really, the Isle of Man's okay, it's fine. I've been there a few times. In fact, my paternal grandmother lived there. So we used to go there on holiday until I was about sort of 5 or 6, I think. And then my paternal grandmother died, but I didn't even know what her name was, you know what I mean? It was a very sort of distant relationship. But anyway, there we go. Now, talking about holidays and all that kind of stuff, and obviously we've got to cope with an economy that's been wrecked. And they're everybody saying, oh, you know, gross domestic product falls as low now as it was in the winter of discontent, which was 1979. Now, you would have been a very young person then, Leslie Ann, but you'd probably have, you know, had a social life with your friends and all that. Do you remember suffering in the winter of discontent, the Great Recession of 1979?
Well, I was still at school, but I remember the trade union strikes.
Yeah.
Jim Callaghan was Prime Minister, I think.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, crisis.
I remember seeing about the picket lines on the news and the hospital closures and so on.
Yes.
But strangely, we were studying Richard III at school at the time, as Shakespeare. Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York. So that's what I remember about it. But I also remember that it was especially cold. There were blizzards, deep snow.
Yeah.
Wasn't it the coldest since 62, 63 or something?
Yeah, that's right. When the football,
and so a lot of people couldn't do their jobs. They people couldn't work because of the weather as well.
Well,
and I remember trudging to school through the snow.
Yes, that's right. Well, do you know what? I've been so lucky. Apparently, there have been four major recessions in the world during my working life, which started when I was about sort of properly when I was about sort of 18. And has gone on now. So it's getting on for, it's over 35 years, right? And I've never noticed the recessions. I was always so tied up in my job that if there was a recession going on around me, it didn't really bother me. You know what I mean? None of my newspapers ever went bankrupt. I was never laid off, never made redundant, nothing like that. But I do remember the winter discontent because I was working on the Birmingham Evening Mail in Redditch, which is a lovely little town on the Worcestershire-Yorkshire border. I was in their district office there. And I didn't think I'd like working out in the country because I wanted to work in Birmingham. But it was a great little town, great stories and all that kind of stuff. And my mate and I, who ran the office together, one night we were going to go out for a drink. Anyway, we couldn't go in the car because the petrol tanker drivers were on strike, okay? So we had to walk to the nearest pub, which was about 2 miles away. When we got there, it was in darkness because all the electricity had gone off because the miners were on strike. The beer had to be brought up from the cellar by hand in buckets, which you drank in candlelight. It was all very, you know, magical because, as you quite rightly say, there was snow on the ground and all that kind of stuff. Every story we wrote for the paper was about bodies piling up at the crematorium because the grave diggers had gone on strike. I mean, it was almost like the country had closed down in a way that we haven't been affected this time at all. We just don't know hardship from what we've just gone through, the 12 weeks of lockdown, compared to then. There were no planes taking off at Heathrow because the air traffic controllers in France had gone on strike. It was just ridiculous. And yet, because we were younger, I suppose, we just coped with it. But I say economic recession has never really hit me. I don't know if it's ever hit you.
Well, you're lucky.
Yeah,
I can't say that it's hit me directly, but something I do remember is the rubbish piling up in Leicester Square.
Absolutely. That was all about as well.
There were rats everywhere. Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Seemed quite. I didn't live in London at the time. I lived out in the sticks.
Yes.
But I remember watching it on television and just being so completely grossed out by the scenes I was seeing on TV.
Yeah.
I think we don't know the half of it. I know that many more people have died during this pandemic than we even know about yet.
Yeah. No, you could be right. And yet, funnily enough, there's a headline on the front of the Daily Telegraph this morning saying that contagion has fallen by half since lockdown was eased from 2 metres to 1 metre. Everybody thought it would go up. It's gone down. Leicester's a special case because there's special family units there. Four generations of the family live together. It's a very close community. They've got to marketplaces and that kind of stuff. But I totally agree with you. I don't think we understand the nature of it at all. Leslie Ann, I'm going to need your help next week, and I'll tell you why. Because I'm going back on television. Delighted to say I'll be rejoining Mr. Jerry Vine. But they've put a caveat on this one, and I've got to do my own makeup. Now, I will obviously have to go to somebody who knows about makeup because I don't. And what on earth I'm going to end up looking like is anybody's guess.
Well, I could offer to come round and give you a lesson.
You see, the problem is it's got to be done in self-isolation still. There's an idea to go back in the studio, and that's still being debated. But even if I go back into the studio, I've got to do my own makeup there, and I will have a proper makeup artist instructing me from 2 metres away. You see what I mean? But they're talking about me having to do it at home here in isolation. I don't know where to start.
Well, there's plenty of videos online. So I'll find you an instructional video and send you the appropriate one. I'll try to find one that won't make you look like Susie Sue or Billy Idol or Boy George. I'll try and find something that looks more realistic.
I would very much appreciate that. That's very good of you. Now, here's a strange question for you. Have you ever seriously thought about killing somebody, or not killing somebody, but if you had to kill somebody, how would you kill them?
Oh, God.
I tell you why I'm asking this rather strange question.
Go on.
It's because Midsummer Murders, I quite like it. You know, I see it occasionally, but only in the background. I wouldn't sit down and watch it. It's 2 hours long. It's a TV programme. But I saw a survey the other day saying that the British people's favourite way of trying to kill somebody would be to strangle them, followed by bludgeoning them, and thirdly, knifing them. And this all came from a survey of fans of Midsummer Murders, where there's a murder in each episode, and there's been about like 200 episodes. But surely at some stage, you must have disliked somebody so much, you thought, if ever I was going to get rid of that person, how would you do it?
No, I never have. I must be honest, I never have thought that I could go the whole hog and kill someone. I find it impossible to believe that people think they could strangle someone, because imagine what strength that would take.
Yeah, I agree.
Bludgeoning somebody to death is a very violent thing to do, and also you again need a lot of strength to do that.
And you get covered in their blood.
Exactly. And to knife somebody is a very horrible thing to do. My mother's next door neighbour got knifed to death in a sort of love triangle scenario that was written about all over the news of the world. I keep a golf club beside my bed.
Right.
And it's been there for donkey's years, ever since I was married and then divorced. You know, I've just always had that there. Could I really hit somebody with that? I don't know, because
if they were threatening your children, you would.
Well, I know, you know, but if you have a weapon in your hand, the chances are that the assailant, the other side, will grab that off you and use that to hurt you with.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right in everything you've said. Incidentally, when you stab somebody, because I spoke to a pathologist about this once, it's like pushing a knife into a bag of crushed ice, apparently. Okay, that's the sensation you feel, okay?
That's what you feel. That's not what the poor victim feels,
is it? No, of course it's not. But I'm like you. Religiously, I couldn't kill anybody unless I thought my own life was under threat or somebody else's was that I was trying to save, because I fear damnation. I do believe that, you know, if you take somebody else's life, then the entrance to heaven is going to be considerably more difficult. If you're a soldier, you get exempted from that and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
But I'm not sure you do. I know a guy at St. Bride's who he won't take communion because he took somebody else's life during a war, and he feels he can't go up to the altar rail and take communion for that.
Yeah.
He feels he doesn't deserve to.
Golly, that is amazing, isn't it? I think only each one of us would know when the actual moment came. But you're absolutely right. It can't be that easy to strangle somebody because the person you're trying to strangle is struggling and punching and hitting out at you and all that kind of stuff. But perhaps it's something that we'll be spared for the rest of our lives.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for being with us today. Leslie Ann, we're still getting some great responses from the audience. They seem to like what we concoct in these podcasts. And I have to say, the stories that you tell us about your life in showbiz are an integral part of the fun and the entertainment. And you're getting a great response.
Yes, thank you very much, everyone. He's taking the time and trouble to write us a few lines. You know, we do enjoy the feedback, so please do keep it coming.
That's right. Where do people get hold of you, Leslie Ann?
Oh, on Twitter at LAJWriter.
Yep, that's right. And they get me at MikeParry8. And then keep sending us your lines of inquiry to planetporkypod@gmail.com. Now then, one person we both met during the course of our lives, although none of us have actually reported on politics per se, is Mr. Tony Blair. And I thought it was really interesting, former Prime Minister, obviously. It's interesting, I think, since we last conversed on this podcast, Leslie Ann, to learn that Tony Blair hasn't done a stroke of housework in any form whatsoever since 1997. When he became the Prime Minister of this country, took over from John Major, got a landslide victory. And quite frankly, that doesn't really surprise me, but there's been a bit of outrage about it.
Well, look, is he really going to do housework? People like them, people like us, frankly, have cleaners, you know?
That's right.
So they pay people to come in and do those kinds of things. I did actually go to his house when he lived in Islington.
Yeah.
He and Cherie lived very near the Albion pub, which was a very popular pub up in Islington in those days.
The original Islington set, weren't they? North London, Islington, Metropolitan Elite Club, yeah?
That's right. And I tell you who lived on the corner as well was Paul Dacre, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Mail, who was my boss at the time.
Right,
well, actually, just before that. So round I go, and Tony Blair wanted to do the interview. It was for the News of the World, this particular piece.
Right.
I had...
Was this before he was Prime Minister or after?
Yeah, no, this was before.
Before the election, right, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I had an interview slot on the News of the World when Piers was my boss there, Piers Morgan.
Yeah.
It was called the Leslie Ann Jones Big Interview. So Tony Blair was my subject this particular week.
Great.
And he wanted to do the interview at his house very early in the morning, before 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
I had a little three-year-old, my firstborn at the time.
Right.
And I couldn't drop her off at nursery beforehand because it was too early.
Right.
So I had to take her with me.
Yeah.
So we arrive at the house and Tony was absolutely delighted that I had this little girl with me. And he sort of took her by the hand. He took us down into the basement kitchen, which was this vast sort of kitchen that took up, from the front of the house to the back.
Yeah, it's what they all have in Islington, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it had, before everybody else had them, it had one of those massive, great American fridges, double sort of fridge.
Two doors.
And yeah, yeah. He said to her, would she like a drink? And she said some milk and he poured the drink for her, sat her down in front of a video. He went through all the videos they had so she could choose which one.
Did he have children at the time?
Yes, he did, yeah.
Yeah, right.
He must have had three at the time.
Right.
Because Leo was born later, wasn't he, while he was Prime Minister.
That's right, yeah.
And then we sat down in the sitting room. We went upstairs to the sitting room to do the interview. And Alistair Campbell stayed downstairs in the kitchen with Mia watching this little Disney video.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
And he was sort of popping up and downstairs to make sure I wasn't overstepping the line and asking anything ridiculous.
Sure.
And at the end of it, Campbell said to me, that's the most he's ever opened up in an interview that in my experience, he said, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is a good ploy here.
Yeah.
Take a little child along to an interview because they soften.
Yeah.
And you get something more out of them than you would otherwise get. So this became a little trick of mine. I did that quite a few times.
You're joking. What, you use your child? You use your child to enhance your professional acumen.
I absolutely did. Shamelessly exploited her.
Oh, my God. I don't know. I mean, Leslie Ann, there's a depth to you which, you know, our audience are suddenly understanding. No, that's a great story. I know Campbell better, Alistair Campbell, better than I know Blair. But on one occasion, when I was resting in between newspaper posts, right, I went and helped out a mate who was starting up a football museum at County Hall, the old County Hall building, okay? And to get it promoted, it was called the Football Hall of Fame and, you know, trying to rope all sorts of people in all over the place. But they actually got, and Blair was in government now. He was in resident in Downing Street, so it must have been about 98, I suppose, something like that, you know. Yeah, 98. And of course, they were very populist. So I still knew Alistair, you know, very well. I'd worked with him in Fleet Street. So I got hold of him and I said, look, what about an endorsement for the Prime Minister? Oh, yeah, he'd love to be associated with football. That's no problem at all, you know. So we went over there to Downing Street. And funny enough, Michael Owen was there at the same time. Don't know why, you know, something else was going on. And so we got this great endorsement from Tony Blair for the new project, which failed within a year, by the way, you know, like a lot of things I've been associated with. And he was absolutely great, you know. Yes, he suggested more pictures, you know, because he wanted them to be all over the place. Tony Blair endorses Football Museum to be man of the football. The only problem was, a bit later on, Tony Blair told a great story about how he first supported Newcastle United and remembered sitting behind the goal with his father cheering on war Jackie, you know, Jackie Milburn. The only problem is the time scale didn't match at all. You know, Blair would have been, you know, 3 months old when Jackie Milburn sort of played his last game or something like that. You know, wouldn't have been able to remember anything. And, of course, there were no seats behind the goals in those days, just vast terraces, you know, the Gallagate end. And he fell down on trying to, you know, be a football fan the same way as David Cameron did, because David Cameron supposedly supported Aston Villa, but couldn't quite remember because he said once he supported West Ham because they both have the same coloured strip. And politicians are like that. They use football to try and be popular. But I didn't have any problems with Tony Blair. He was a consummate politician. I've got political reservations about the war he got us into with George Bush, but that's for another time. But I know Alistair very well since the early days of his career. Alistair, very complicated man. Alistair has had, you know, he struggled with his inner demons all his life. When we were in Fleet Street, do you remember the wine press, obviously?
Oh, yeah, very well.
Of course you do, of course you do.
Inside out, very well.
Yeah, I'm going to say, anybody who worked in Fleet Street who doesn't remember the wine press didn't work in Fleet
Street.
Wasn't
there.
Exactly, that's right, yeah. And Alistair started off working on the Daily Star. And I worked on the Daily Express. We're both in the same building, both young reporters, and often end up on the same doorstep together. But I've seen Alistair drink 18 pints during a late-night doorstep. You know what I mean? I remember one we went to, and it couldn't have been designed better for the drinking journalist. There was a window which looked straight across in the pub at the door we'd be doorstepping. We literally doorstepped from the pub, leaning on a table in the pub, and the barman regularly bring us pints. And we started in there about 5. We were still there at midnight, locked in, because the pub closed at 11. And that was Alistair's drinking days. And he was an absolutely voracious drinker, you know what I mean? But I mentioned the wine press because he was very political. And about 18 months later, after he'd gone to the Daily Mirror, he gave me a call and said, I'm having a celebration wine press. And he'd been appointed a political reporter on the Daily Mirror. And that was the start of his ascension to where he became the most powerful political advisor in this country, probably until now with Dominic Cummings, you know. But, I mean, the power that Alistair wielded in Whitehall from being a young reporter with me was breathtaking, honestly.
It was an astonishing rise to power as well, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
From the Daily Star to number 10.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. He ruled in number 10. He, like they say Cummings does now. He really did, honestly. And it was astonishing. And, of course, eventually those guys become unobtainable. You know, you can't suddenly ring him up again and all that kind of stuff. And I remember one time, because the mother of Alistair's children is a lady called Fiona Miller, okay?
Yep, Facebook friend. Yeah, no, I knew Fiona.
Yeah, Fiona, yeah. Well, Fiona worked for me at The Express when I became news editor. She was a reporter. She, too, had huge political ambitions and was always onto me. Can't I work in the Commons and all that? I said, I'll give you first refusal on the next vacancy. Vacancy came. She went and worked at the Commons. Her dad was a guy called Bob Miller. He was the father of the chapel. They were rooted in sort of trade unionism and all that. But Fiona herself was very, very ambitious. Never got married, her and Alistair, had children, you know, brought them up and all done very well, obviously. And a few years later, when I needed to get hold of Alistair, I still had their home number. And I rang this number because it was desperate I got hold of Alistair to try and confirm some story or otherwise. And Fiona was very off with me. You know, what are you doing ringing my home? I said, hang on. I said, you were a reporter on the Daily Express when I was a news editor 5 years ago. You know what I mean?
I made you who you are today.
Sort of. You know, I sent you to the Commons. I gave you the backing to be a political reporter. And all that kind of stuff. It's astonishing the way
they forget.
Yeah, they do. Now, tell me this. Are you a big fan of Prince?
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
Right.
Absolutely love Prince.
All his, some of his LPs are now being reissued in vinyl. Vinyl's suddenly become very big again, hasn't it? And I read a review of the reissued vinyl LPs. And more, since he died in particular, the verdict from any reviewer is that Prince is the genius we never recognised when he was alive. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think a lot of us did recognise it when he was alive.
Yeah.
The thing is, Prince released hundreds upon hundreds of songs over a nearly 40-year career.
Yes.
If you compare that to Jimi Hendrix, who was as broadly talented as Prince,
yeah,
but he made 3 studio albums. The Beatles were only together for 8 years.
Yes.
Prince, his output was absolutely extraordinary.
Well, we talked about the records he wrote for other people. You know, we've done all that, but I didn't realise that, you know, that people say he had sort of musical techniques which he invented himself.
Oh, yeah. And the thing about him, he was not only a multi-instrumentalist, he was an incredible lyricist.
Yep.
He was an amazing songwriter. His harmony arrangements, his very skilled production techniques, this kind of thing. He is, by himself, one of the great American songbooks.
Right.
You know, there is his most impressive thing for me is that he wrote from both the male and female perspectives.
Right.
Very, very few songwriters can do that.
Yeah.
And structurally and technically, his songs were just way out there. You know, there's a song called 3 Chains of Gold. I don't know if you know that one, but it's Bohemian Rhapsody times 4.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
And then, of course, great songs like When Doves Cry, Kiss, Sign of the Times,
oh, golly.
Purple Rain.
Yeah.
Purple Rain, which I wish nobody would ever cover because nobody should ever cover that song.
Right.
That is indelibly Prince. It's like trying to do Bohemian Rhapsody, isn't it? If you're not Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
Nobody else should ever sing American Pie.
Yeah.
There are a handful of songs that should be untouched by other artists.
Sure.
Because they're connected to him. But yeah, I think we always knew that Prince was a genius.
Yeah. I'm going to start re-listening to some of his music on Spotify now. And you're absolutely right. When I was in America in the 80s, I used to wake up every morning to the strains of That's Why Doves Fly. What was that called?
When Doves Cry.
When Doves Cry, that's right, yeah, because it was such a...
I quite like your version, though.
Yeah, that's right. Talking about extremely talented artists, have you ever read the book that almost everybody in the world is supposed to have read, and that is Dan Brown's The Da Vinci... what's the name? What's it called?
Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
I did read it a long time ago. I don't know whether it's me. I didn't think it was all that thrilling, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I got 2/3 of the way through it, and I thought the pace of it was very fast, but then it slowed down as you went through the book, you know what I mean? And I started not to understand it. I didn't realise in the end it was all about the mother of Jesus being at the Last Supper or something like that, and I got bored and stopped reading it. But the reason I'm asking, of course, is because Dan Brown... the man who's said to have made £2 billion out of the books he's written, including The Da Vinci Code, is now been found out to be a philanderer of the First Order and have four mistresses on the go at once, his wife is claiming, in what's going to be a very messy separation.
Are we surprised? But going back before that, there was a long-running court case, wasn't there? Some other writers brought against him, saying that he was a plagiarist and that the premise of the Da Vinci Code wasn't his original story.
Yes, that's right. It was, yeah. Did he win that? I think he won it, didn't he?
I think he did, on a technicality. But, you know, that sort of smacks of a propensity to be dishonest, which is what you have to be in order to be an adulterer.
Well, that's quite a complicated link. I mean, let's make it clear, first of all, on this podcast, we're in no way accusing Mr. Dan Brown of plagiarism of any sort, and you nobly defended your name in court. But to say that a bloke who's accused of plagiarism also has the instincts to be a philanderer, that's a very feminist attack, I think, on a male.
Well, do you think so? Because if you're going to have a mistress, you have to be able to lie to your wife. It's a very basic thing.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah. Yeah, but you know, millions of men do it without
Oh, that makes it okay, does it?
Oh, no,
I don't think so.
No, it doesn't make it okay, but it doesn't mean that they're plagiarists necessarily.
Yeah, but the funny bit here is that not just one mistress, but four mistresses. Yeah, so four, presumably he's two-timing the first mistress with the second mistress,
that's
with
right.
the third, with
yeah.
the fourth. So
yeah.
how does he, what does he do? Like, keep a chart?
Well,
how do you keep track of all those women?
Well,
how do you know which one is which? Well, how do you call them the right name and put the right photograph out before they come round?
Well, you may be right, but if you're a billionaire, you may have one on four separate continents, mightn't you? And you might be sort of doing the rounds with a private jet or something like that. That's what being wealthy and rich is all about, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And if you've got, you could have a sort of mistress consultant. So they make sure that, you know, you've got like a crib sheet with all the right details of the one that you're about to go and see, that kind of thing.
I'm sure many men have over the years. Honest to God, I'm sure if you're that wealthy, you can probably do it. Talking about wealth, by the way, I just want to touch on a story which fascinates me. I'm fascinated by wealth and rich people, but even more fascinated by self-made rich people. And I read an obituary. I do read obituaries because they fascinate me. Usually if they're war heroes, they've been Spitfire pilots or something like that, who at the age of 19 climbed into a Spitfire. And what 19-year-old boys complain about these days, you know what I mean? Oh, you know, the internet's not working or something. And and fought the Luftwaffe. But anyway, this chap is called Tony Pidgley, and an amazing man. He's died recently, and he built one of the biggest house-building operations in this country called Barclay. He's died relatively young, actually, 72. And he himself was, if not a billionaire, he had hundreds of millions, according to the Sunday Times Rich List. But the most fascinating thing about him is that he was a Barnardo's boy, given away as a very, very young child and adopted by a traveller couple who lived in a caravan. And that's how he was brought up. And by the age of 14 or 15, had taught himself to be a bricklayer. By the age of 20... He bought a lorry first to carry his bricks around in, and then he realised that if he had two lorries, he'd be able to transport two. At the age of 20, he had a haulage firm with 20 lorries. By the age he was 22, he'd sold it and made himself very wealthy, then started building houses, and then, as I say, became one of Britain's biggest house builders. And I just have nothing but admiration for people like that.
Where does it come from? I think, you know, deprivation, dysfunction in one's childhood, that drive to make something of yourself. But there are many thousands of children born in, let's call them, dilapidated circumstances.
Yes.
And very few of them rise from caravan to rich list.
Exactly.
Do they? So I wonder what ingredient it is. What is the element that pops out of their brain that drives them and leads them to become so successful?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Sorry about these noises if you're getting them. It's my computer sending me instructions about all sorts of things. Please ignore it. You may not have heard that bing that just came up. I totally agree with you. I mean... Everybody would say, well, that's easy. You know, once you learn to be a bricklayer, you learn how to build walls so you can build houses. No, you can't. If we could all do it like that, we'd all be millionaire, you know, house builders. And, you know, oh, he bought a lorry and then he realised he had a second lorry. It's the drive, the determination, the sheer willpower to succeed, because we've all tried things in our lives which haven't worked, and they usually don't work because we don't have the will to see them through. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we all have drive and we all have commitment, and there is something that separates those guys from us. But it reminds me, I knew a couple years ago when my son was at Dulwich College, there was you used to meet other parents and have dinner parties and all that kind of stuff. And there was one particular couple we became very friendly with. I can't even remember their names.
Yeah.
Isn't that awful? But the guy, he made much of the fact that he'd been a dustman who went to Cambridge University. So he started out...
I remember the story.
Yeah, yeah, and he wrote a book about it.
Yeah, that's right.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But this was his kind of claim to fame, you know, and he used to openly say it in front of all these quite well-to-do people at various dinner parties from time to time. He was very proud of the fact that he'd started out in the gutter, among the rubbish, and that he'd risen, taken himself to Cambridge University, become a sort of maths expert, and was now running his own corporation.
Utterly fantastic. There's another house builder, and it's gone right out of my head at the moment. I'm sorry, just one of those things. But he wanted to buy Liverpool Football Club. He failed, and so he bought Wolverhampton Wanderers Football Club as well. And I know him because I've met him at, you know, football matches and that kind of stuff. Just gone out of my head. But he did exactly the same. He was a bricklayer who found enough bricks to build one house, sold it for twice the money it cost to build it, and then built two more houses, and then sold them for, you know, double the money. And he, again, became a hugely successful house builder just simply through the back-breaking work of hauling his own bricks around and building bricks. He also told me that of the hundreds of thousands of homes which have been built in this country under the control of his companies, he's done almost all the snagging lists himself. A snagging list is when a house has been finished, somebody's bought it, and then the purchaser goes into the house with the site surveyor, and you point out all the wrong things, as you probably know. You know, the window frame, sorry, the window won't shut properly, the lock doesn't work on the door, the tap's loose, and the snag list means that you get all those fixed before you move in. And Redrow was the company, and the man's name is Steve. I'm awfully sorry, I've forgotten it. But I was so impressed with the, you know, the attention to detail this gave. That's why he said people trusted me when they bought my houses. And I think it's that. I think Branson's got that sort of trust, hasn't he, from his customers?
Yeah, he does. Now, that people do tend to say that Richard Branson has Asperger's syndrome. You know, it's the modern kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That people with drive, people like Winston Churchill, Richard Branson, many, many other examples. John Lennon often comes up as a candidate on that list.
Yeah.
Of course, the diagnosis didn't exist way back then. Mm. We've only officially had Asperger's syndrome in this country since the 1980s.
Wow.
But it could be that there could be some switch in the brain that flicks that maybe doesn't function on another level, but which allows them to pour attention into one particular facet of development.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Absolutely. It could be. Right, Leslie Ann, thank you very much indeed. You mentioned John Lennon there, so I'll just mention to you that my housekeeper, lovely woman, during the course of lockdown, she is a ceramicist, that is a woman who repairs pottery and all that kind of stuff, and she has a little studio. She also does a bit of sketching and painting. She's done me a picture of John Lennon because she knows I'm a huge Lennon fan, for which I want to thank her. It's lovely. I've shown it to you. You think it's rather a good illustration of John, yeah?
I think it's such a great likeness. She's really talented. So why is she your housekeeper? Why is she cleaning your carpets?
Well, no, for years she had the ceramicist thing as well, but she had a little house cleaning company, if you see what I mean. You know, there were three or four of them, and then she got a bit older, all dropped off. She decided to stay with me. It's as simple as that, you know. So as simple as that. But look, what I'll do is, as the podcast comes out this morning, I will put out the John Lennon picture on Twitter, so people can have a look at it, and we welcome all their responses. So, Leslie Ann, thank you very much indeed for joining me today. Hope you have a great weekend, and obviously a very cautious and careful weekend as lockdown descends upon us.
Stay safe and stay sober would be my advice.
Very good advice indeed. Okay, folks, until next week. She had a theory about her own background, didn't she?
Yeah, she Well, she told me this one night after a lot of drink.
Yeah.
She said, although I tracked down who I presume to have been my birth mother, yeah, a concert pianist living in Miami, who rejected her. This was the kind of official story. She said she believed that she was the actual daughter of one of the greatest Hollywood sirens ever known.
Really?
Yeah.
Golly.
And she told me who she thought it was as well.
Yeah.
Now, I worked it out. I went away and did a bit of sleuthing. Yeah. This particular siren would have been about 19 when Debbie was born in 1945.
Golly.
So perfectly possible. There's a very similar look as well. I compared pictures.
It doesn't take much of an imagination to guess who you might be talking about there.
So this became a little trick of mine. I did that quite a few times after.
You're joking.
That.
Well, you used You used your child to enhance your professional acumen.
I absolutely did. Shamelessly exploited her.
Oh, my God. I don't know. I mean, Leslie Ann, there's a depth to you which, you know, our audience are suddenly understanding. Have you ever seriously thought about killing somebody, or not killing somebody, but if you had to kill somebody, how would you kill them?
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.